Good morning, all. It's another beautiful day. Your attention, please.
Hey everyone, thanks again for checking out Back in the Village, the Prisoner podcast, where we're covering all 17 episodes of the British sci-fi classic The Prisoner. Today we'll be covering Dance of the Dead, and the only note I have is that I get confused about what number episode this is. This is episode number 8, not episode number 9. So I should probably listen to my own show. Oh, as of the posting of this episode, we are now on iTunes. So if you could find the kindness in your heart to leave us a nice review or a rating, we would be much obliged. Anyway, here's Dance of the Dead. Enjoy. Good morning, good morning. Welcome again to Back in the Village, the Prisoner podcast. With me again is Wes. How are you doing, Wes?
Good, Clay. How are you today?
Not too bad, not too bad. Today we are talking about Dance of the Dead.
Good title.
Yeah, and I think right up front we should, I don't know if you plan on gloating about this at some point, but we should probably right away mention that in this episode we finally get a definitive answer about how number 6 feels about women.
Yeah. Well, it's been a long, what is this the 8th episode?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, it's been a long seven episodes to get to this very, very distinct and important point in this series' history.
Which is when he very clearly and emphatically says, never trust a woman.
That's right. even if she's got four legs.
Yes.
Yeah. I feel his betrayal by the cat was like it hit him the hardest, I think, out of anything I've seen in the series so far. And the cat didn't even make a conscious decision to do anything to him. It just was taken.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, you think you can trust. You finally find someone you can trust, and then, you know, even that is taken away from you.
Yeah. Are you you're a dog person, right?
Yeah. I'm not a cat person whatsoever.
No. I'm always it hits me on like a visceral level when I see men petting cats for some reason. I find it very upsetting, and I know that some people really love their cats and like the internet really loves cats. I can't relate to these animals like that, and number 6 in this one seems to be a cat guy more than a dog guy.
Yeah, well, I think that's the only, unfortunately, the only animal we ever see in the village, because as we also learn in this episode, they appear to be forbidden.
Oh, that's right. I was thinking of he runs into the gypsy dog in last episode, but that's not in the village, as you say.
Right.
You'll never win.
Then how very uncomfortable for you, old chap.
So, this episode, I was trying to figure out the best way to approach talking about this episode, because there's some information about the production that I think might change the way we think about it in terms of what they do in this episode and how it falls in the placement of everything.
Sure.
So I'm going to go through, I'm going to give a fairly, hopefully fairly brief summary of what happens.
Okay.
And then I'll say what that extra info is, and then we can go on and talk about it from there.
Sure. Can I get one tiny bit of information from you first?
Sure.
If you had to give this, let's see, what would be like a one descriptive word you would call this show, this episode?
This episode specifically?
Yeah.
Probably dreamlike.
Okay. Okay. That's good. That's good enough for me. I wanted to sort of gauge how you were going to come at it, and I think that's been helpful to me. So yeah, if you want to start.
Well, again, what I have to tell you about the production may impact your thoughts. So
sure.
Okay, so for a breakdown, this episode is different because it actually starts in the middle of an attempt to break number 6.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet this character named Roland Walter Dutton, who apparently was someone 6 worked with as before he was brought to the village. And 2 interrupts this attempt and says, oh, we don't want to break him, and we need him to come willingly, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, sort of a callback to it with the earlier episode. They say that same sort of thing. I forget which episode that was, but they don't want to break him.
Right, right. Yeah. It seems to be the running theme that they which, you know, but maybe we can get into this later as well, but it's actually really interesting when you think about that, because it really adds a very heavy level of importance to number six.
Yes.
Especially as you see what happens to Dutton at the end of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next day, number two tells number six about the costume party that's coming up, and number two being a woman this time, and she actually says to number six that maybe he should just find a nice girl to shack up with and bring to the party.
Yeah, right.
Number six has his eye on this one woman, and number two says she's off limits, and this is number 240, who turns out to be number six's observer, which is another element that was around in the first episode but hasn't appeared since.
Okay, yeah. There's first of all, good on you for I never get these supplementary characters numbers. 240.
Yeah, I tend to try and grab them because otherwise there's no way to talk about them.
Yeah, see, I'd call her a little Bo Peep.
Yes, yeah, there you go. Okay, yeah, that would work too. And then that night, number six tries flat out to escape, but is blocked by Rover, excuse me.
Yep.
He falls asleep on the beach, and when he wakes up, he finds a dead body that has a radio in the pocket. He pockets
well-made radio, too.
Yes, yeah. He pockets the radio and drags the body out of the water and hides it, and he puts a note with the body. I assume some sort of basically a really dark version of putting a note into a bottle and throwing it back into the river.
Yeah, exactly.
Because what he plans to do is wrap the body up with a life preserver and throw him back in the water and hope someone finds him.
Yeah.
So then he goes to the party, and which is a costume party, and everybody's in a fancy costume or, you know, various weird things, except for him, who he is. Except for number six, who is in his own tuxedo.
Yes.
Very
carnival-esque party.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's like a really...
sort of like Eyes Wide Shut without the sex.
I was just going to say, yes. Eyes Wide Shut without the sex. He manages to slip away and does some snooping around, and he finds the morgue, where he finds the body that he thought he got rid of, but apparently the village has grabbed.
Mm-hmm.
And number two tells him that they will be changing the note, or at least changing the information in this body's pocket, to make it look like number six has actually died at sea.
Yes.
And so after that exchange, which is where he says never trust a woman, he goes back, makes his way back to the party, where he is then put on trial, because having the radio that he found in the body is explicitly forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
And he's put on trial with a three-judge system, which they say is the same style they used during the French Revolution.
Yeah, I wrote down, that's the one historical fact I learned from this. I don't know if that's true, but it certainly sounds like it could be true.
It actually is true. Okay. I did look that up.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, in this episode, it's the only one you learn, and you don't learn it in 15 seconds.
Yeah, right. And he's put in it's a kangaroo court, because his defender is also sort of being called as a witness against him.
Right.
So it's obviously all rigged against him. And who are the three judges? It's like Queen Elizabeth, Napoleon, and...
And Caesar, I think.
Caesar, that makes sense, yeah.
And it's not looking good for him in the trial, so he wants to call a character witness. So he calls on Dutton, who he knew before he was there. And when they bring Dutton out, Dutton is dressed as a harlequin,
court jester.
Court jester. And he's clearly been lobotomized.
Yes.
And so after that point, number six has nothing else to say, so he is sentenced. He is found guilty, and he is sentenced to death, which is incredibly harsh.
Right. And he's given a 5-second head start.
Right. Yeah. He takes off, and they start chasing him, and he makes his way back through the morgue and through a clear, very convenient trap door on the floor of the morgue.
Mm-hmm.
And finds himself in this very ornate office, where he finds a telex machine, or I'm not exactly sure what it's doing, but it's printing, it's receiving data and printing it out.
Yeah.
And he feels the need to just kick the shit out of it.
Well, he like tears the guts out of the machine. He tears right, all the wires out.
Unfortunately, he doesn't beat anybody's ass this week. So I guess this is the closest. Yeah, this is the closest we get to a gratuitous ass beating. So then after he breaks the machine, number two comes in and tells him that the exact exchange is something to the effect of, why are they chasing me? And then number two says, because they don't know you're already dead.
Yeah.
And
she sort of stresses that he's unique. He's the only one that's ever been in that room.
Right.
He's allowed to look out a one-way mirror at them and they can't see him.
Right.
And she sort of mentions that he's unique and different from the rest of the people that are in this party.
Right. And after that exchange, she tells him that he's already dead. The telex machine that looks like it has been thoroughly dismantled starts up again and starts printing. Number two laughs maniacally, and we get, that's the end of the episode. So that's the episode. Now, the information that I wanted to tell you.
Well, I'll never tell you any information.
Is that if you had to guess, when do you think this episode was shot in the production order?
This should have been shot second. If it wasn't, if this episode was not produced early, I don't know what to think about it.
Right. Well, you're close. This episode was produced fourth.
Okay.
But it was one of three possible second episodes. Oh. So the other two, I believe, were Free for All and
Chimes of Big Ben.
The other second episode, possible episode, is actually Checkmate, which is the next episode we'll be watching.
Oh, okay. I think that says a lot about the like production behind the show. I assume they're doing that to save time, to just sort of get scripts going.
Yep.
And they obviously haven't storyboarded anything, and are just sort of like we need a buffer before we start breaking into later shows. So you three write a script, and write it so vaguely that it could happen anytime early on in the show's run.
Yeah, it's very interesting because it's number six has the same kind of attitude towards the village in this episode that he had in a lot of the earlier episodes. Like we've talked before about how you can kind of determine a running order that makes sense as for a character arc for six.
Yeah.
Based on how he reacts to the village and what his escape attempts are, et cetera, et cetera. And in this one, he's very clearly still in that angry phase.
Well, yeah, and he's still, like, he still thinks he can outrun Rover. You know, it's right, like, it's right. been, yeah, so he's very early in the state of anything is sort of possible. You know, there's no... He hasn't run into any brick walls that the village has set up against him.
Right.
So he's really rehashing everything that he's done previously.
Mm. And the other interesting thing I like about this episode is it's actually the most prison-like we've seen the actual village up to this point. Because you get a lot of instances of they're enforcing a curfew where at night... he has an exchange with the maid of his house about never seeing a knight or something like that.
Because, yeah.
And then later on he tries to stay up, and they induce a nightlight that's supposed to knock him out. I guess.
Yeah, and I just love that scene because it's like it's one of those things that would probably, if it was a modern show, have like a seizure warning because it was like I was getting a headache like for how long the light was flashing in his eyes.
Yeah,
and it's just telling him to go to sleep or whatever. But yeah. It's same with the Like in this one, we're told that the televisions watch you in the village, you know, mm-hmm. so if you try to cover them up like they're a security camera, they make this horrible shrieking noise.
Right, right. And even his escape attempt, which is very short-lived, is just flat out making a break for it.
Mm-hmm.
It has no finesse or ingenuity of his previous attempts.
Right.
It's yeah. just he jumps out the window and just makes a break for the water.
Yep.
Music, come along. You've been practicing long enough. And dance. Enjoy yourself. It's carnival.
I rarely drink.
Then you'll enjoy it all the more. Self-denial is a great sweetener of pleasure.
The one of the other orders puts this, actually a few of the other orders that are published other places put this episode second.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a good second episode.
Oh, really? We're probably gonna have a lot to talk about here.
No, I think it's a good. I think four would be a great place to put it.
Uh huh.
I think two. I think it's too weird for a second episode, especially because the way it starts. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was the structure.
Sure.
So it starts, like I said before, in the middle of an attempt to break number six. And I feel like if you're going from Arrival, where they don't actually really do anything to him to try and really break him.
Yeah.
And then directly into an episode that starts in the middle of some weird, like, mind control while he's sleeping thing. And then they just kind of ditch that after 5 minutes and go into this whole other weird, dreamy story about finding a dead body that looks like him and this weird costume party. That's a really big jump.
It is. It's I don't know if I should. All right. Well, I guess I'm gonna give you my general impression of
sure.
what happened
yes.
when I watched it. So I think it'll clear up our avenues for discussion here.
Mm.
I watched this twice. Mm-hmm. I watched it the first time, and I thought it was so bad that it annoyed me. Have you ever seen Punch Drunk Love?
Yes.
Watching this one the first time made me feel like I felt when I was watching Punch Drunk Love. And the thing about Punch Drunk Love is that I think Punch Drunk Love is intentionally designed to make the viewer like super annoyed.
Yeah.
Because of how Adam Sandler's character acts and how like there's the music throughout the whole thing is just sort of like building tribal drums that just sort of like build as these mm-hmm. like horrible scenes are sort of happening. And you're just sort of, you're getting super like angry and annoyed by the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I felt when I watched it the first time. I felt like nothing happened in it, and it was so meaningless as to be like upsetting to me. I watched it again just to see what would happen, and I liked it much, much more the second time I saw it.
Yeah.
And I also think that my annoyed disposition towards the first time I watched it was because it felt like so much of a retread that I was just like, God, like he's already done all this. I don't understand
right, right.
why we're doing this again. And he did it six episodes ago.
Right.
And if I watched it the second time thinking this would be a lot better as an early show, because it's by far the darkest of the episodes we've seen.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, I mean, it's got a dead body in it that he fishes, yeah. fishes out of the water. And I think that this is one time where the tone of the show did a little bit of a disservice to what it was trying to say in this episode,
mm-hmm.
because I was not getting the first time I was watching it how sort of desperate and violent the whole situation was.
Yeah, yeah.
It seemed too lighthearted the first time I saw it, so I didn't really understand. But the rewatch like really clarified everything for me. So that's how I felt. I ended up really liking it, but I think that where I saw it in the order and the general tone of what they were doing made it not very easy to watch the first time.
Yeah, no, I totally know what you're saying. This is an episode where I think I had the same feeling the first time I watched it. I very clearly remember seeing this episode and thinking it felt like an incomprehensible just mess.
Yeah.
My other piece of information that I have to tell you might play to that a little bit. But
it's just, I think it goes back into the, because I've mentioned that before as a criticism. I don't know if this is just of the era of what television was doing, mm-hmm. but the show gives no stress to anything that it thinks is important to the plot.
Right.
It just kind of happens. And like, you know, when he meets Dutton in the cave, for whatever reason, I sometimes find it hard to pay attention to what the characters are saying mm-hmm. in the show. And I think it's because they tend to be sort of flowery and sparring with each other when they talk. And I don't really pay attention to the plot mechanics of what they're saying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the second time around, once I knew where things were going, it's much more clarifying, like what's going on. Like when Six is listening to his radio,
mm-hmm.
the first time I watch it, that's the kind of thing in shows, at least for me personally, I hardly ever really pay attention to what the radio is saying. Mm-hmm. I see that he's on screen listening to a radio and he probably shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And I don't internalize what the thing is actually saying. Mm-hmm. But on a rewatch, you're much more observant about what's going on. And it's like stuff like that just kind of flies under the radar the first time you see it.
Yeah, I was the radio thing I really liked. Did you find any particular meaning in what was being said? Because I tried specifically to listen to it, and it didn't really stand out to me as something that had any sort of weight.
I just thought it was sort of the it's the village sort of flooding the airwaves with like mm-hmm. sort of like a Orwellian nonsense kind of.
Right,
and he—it was sort of just showing that he's really isolated because this is all that you can pick up in this. You're like, no matter how high the mountain you're going to climb to get some signal, that's all you're going to pick up.
Right, right.
I have a message for you. You must listen. The appointment cannot be fulfilled. Other things must be done tonight. If our torment is to end, if liberty is to be restored, we must grasp the nettle. Even though it makes our hands bleed. Only through pain can tomorrow be assured.
Interestingly, the other piece of information that I have for you is that this episode, the reason it falls so late in the run, well, it's kind of in the middle, but compared to when it was shot.
Well, yeah, for what its plot is detailing, it's right, very late, right. So yeah.
Is because apparently McGoohan hated the first cut so much that he was going to scrap it.
Okay.
He put it on the shelf and just was not going to use it until the editor took another look at it and said, you know, I think I can make something out of this.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I've never read the original script. I don't know what the original, how different the original script is. But knowing that, thinking back to the first time I watched it, I feel like it stands out. It's weird because usually that stuff works the other way where it's like if you watch something, if that sort of editing job has been done to something to the point where it's noticeable, the first time you watch it, it doesn't stand out as much. But then, you know, the more you have to think about it, the more you think about it and look at it again, you can see, oh, well, yeah, clearly this scene doesn't really make sense, you know, that kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
But this one I feel like is the reverse because, like you said, first time you watched it, you didn't like it, you thought it was a mess. First time I watched it, I didn't like it, I thought it was a mess. But going back and watching it again, the edit job that they did really adds to this weird, dreamlike, as I said earlier, state that of the things that are happening. It's just sort of like, it's kind of floating along.
It is,
and
yeah.
You're getting these different beats that are, that aren't necessarily, like you said, they're not emphasized, but they're just weird enough to stand out when you really kind of think about them. Like, the one thing I noticed this time, just a little detail, is in the, unless this is what morgues look like in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
He gets to the morgue by going through what basically looks like a filing cabinet room.
No, it was probably because I was so aggravated the first time. The first time I watched it, I didn't even realize that a body was in there. I must have turned away or something when he pulled the body out and looked at it,
mm-hmm.
Because I was in there, and I honestly just thought it was a filing cabinet room, and I thought he had found a file or something the way that they were talking to him.
Well, that's what the thing that I noticed that I loved is when he gets into the part that's the morgue, he's pulling these bodies out, in what look like gigantic filing cabinets.
Yeah, like the kind like in the opening credits where his file gets dropped into when he's resigned.
Right,
yeah.
Which is a really nice, you know, little metaphor,
yep.
if you will,
yep.
To the way that they view the people in this village.
Yeah.
And it's beats like that and just the way he finds the body by falling asleep on the beach and then waking up and it's just sort of floating there on the shore.
Yeah.
And the party is so weird. Like even, I don't know if this is intentional, but it was weird enough that it stood out to me because the music that they're playing, so he gets to the party and even when he shows up at the party, it's really kind of weird and dreamy where everybody is lining the hallways and he walks in and everybody turns and looks at him.
Yeah, yeah.
And as he walks down the hallway, the people behind him all sort of fall in
yep.
behind him and follow him in, which is, you know, pretty creepy. and then once the party starts and everybody starts dancing, the music that's being played is this, like, sort of mid-tempo classical piece.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, everybody there is dancing like they're playing the theme from American Bandstand. You know, there's... I kept, the second time I was watching, I kept looking at the background people, and they're all just, you know, cutting it up.
Right.
to this music that is not fitting. It's like it's just too slow to fit the kind of dancing that they're doing.
Right, exactly, yeah. It's either intentional or a horrible production mistake that might seem, they're playing like actual dance music when they're filming or something, and instead this is what's put in post.
Well, I bet they're probably not playing any music at all, honestly.
Yeah, probably not.
Because, you know, the way that sound editing goes, I'm sure it's just people just dancing in the background.
Yeah, just being told to dance around. That's, right. It's funny you mentioned that. Actually, I broke my notes down into sections. And my first technical note is this a new sound recorder working on this show? Because the sound recording in this episode is horrible. Did you notice that?
I didn't. No.
Okay. I think it's just because of the amount of location shooting they were doing when they're outside and he's listening to his radio
mm-hmm.
and number two comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You can barely hear what she's saying when she first appears. It's almost like they weren't able to catch her audio outside.
Mm.
And then when they're in the morgue, there's this like horrible echo to what they're saying. And it's just kind of a weird thing. Like they must be shooting so rapidly that they can't accommodate for the spaces that they're in.
Right.
Yeah. It's just kind of a weird thing.
I was watching back a bit of the documentary that comes with the Blu-ray,
mm-hmm.
and I caught one piece of it where one of the future number twos was telling a story about how they were going so fast and. People were coming in and shooting these episodes without them really knowing what was going on.
Right, yeah.
And there was a point where the director comes up to the guy playing number two and says, "Do you have any idea what's going on?" And number two says, "No, I'm just here to do it.
I'm here for the day, yeah."
Yeah, and he's like, "Oh, I mean, I don't know what's going on." He's like, "Well, have you seen any of the show?" Like, "No, I haven't seen any of it." "Okay, well, watch the first episode, and then you'll figure it out." And he's like, "Oh, okay, I get it now." But
that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think that adds to a lot of the legend of the disorganization of the show and
right because and, I mean disorganization kind of creates a symbolic mythos, you know, almost like the lack of things connecting becomes meaning later on.
Right, right, and you know, there are two sides to it where you know. People say, "Oh, McGoohan didn't have any idea what he was doing and was losing control of the ship." And then the other side is like, "No, he knew exactly what he was doing." And,
yeah, see, I'd be inclined to think that he knew what he was doing because his episodes that he's like written and directed
mm-hmm.
are probably my favorites.
Yeah.
So I think he might just be a terrible communicator to other people about.
Honestly, that would not surprise me at all.
Yeah.
I think he was notoriously short. So.
Yeah. Just fucking shoot it.
Right, right.
Stop. You'll damage the brain, then we all be.
Stop. Get that man back to the hospital.
Number six was about to talk.
Don't you believe it? He'd have died first. You can't force it out of this man. He's not like the others.
I would have made him talk. Every man has his breaking point.
I don't want him broken. He must be won over. It may seem a long process to your practical mind, but this man has a future with us. There are other ways.
But yeah, so the we kind of went way off, but the...
Oh, I'm sorry,
the structure.
Yeah.
No, it's fine. But going way back, the structure of this episode really fascinates me.
Okay.
Because it's like number two calls off the attempt to break him, basically, like right at the beginning of the show.
Yes.
And says, I've got something else. Well, I don't know if she actually says this, but she basically has something else in store. And now...
Well, she's sort of he's too important to be rough with. She's like, you can fuck up Dutton because he's unimportant.
Right.
So she lets that sort of swarmy British scientist who really just wants to seem to want to lobotomize people. She lets him at Dutton, and Six gets to sort of walk around the village for a little bit.
Right, and the structure doesn't feel like an early episode because it feels like the kind of twist on the structure that you would do later in the series. So, like, if you've already set up this pre-existing formula of, oh, number two is trying to break number six, number six figures out a way to get around it and tries to escape, and that's the whole crux of the show.
Right.
This is kind of like an episode that takes place around those ideas.
Yes.
Because you've got an attempt to break him at the beginning. You've gotten an escape attempt towards the middle, but neither of those are integral to the plot. What's
right,
integral, yeah. What ends up being the plot of the show is, like you said earlier, the darkest thing they've done by a long shot. Because where previously they've tried to break his spirit and they've tried to...
just get him to talk, basically.
Yeah, get him to talk, to forget his identity, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
This one, they literally kill him, and he is dead to the rest of the world.
Yeah, he's... which is interesting, you know, because I think it goes back to the issue of why wouldn't you air this one first? Because his death is the reason why no one's looking for him. You know?
Right, right.
Like, if you go at it from that angle, it's sort of setting the stage... the plot of this one is really setting the stage as to why he's in the situation he is.
Mm-hmm.
And it coming so late in the show run is kind of a strange thing to be saying at this point. When it seems in the episodes before this, it seems like he knows what's at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this show really just does a good job of explaining, even if it's not 100% like forceful and emphatic about what it's trying to say, it's in there. And
right.
I think it's important to get that out early on.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I actually find interesting about the placement is you've got inside the episode, one of the big reasons that it's referenced as being an early episode is because Six makes many mentions of being new to the village.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it actually answers some questions for me in its placement where it is in the way we're watching it. It answers some questions that I had about Many Happy Returns, which is, I mean, why don't they come? They clearly know where the place is. Why don't they come looking for him after he doesn't return from this plane trip?
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And if they send out that he's dead, then they're probably not going to come looking for him.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I
suppose. Also,
that's true.
The Black Cat shows up in this episode, which also shows up in Many Happy Returns as well, which is not a coincidence.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
It's not a coincidence because they were both written by the same guy.
Oh, really? He just likes this cat as like a symbol?
I guess. Oh. Yeah, it's the third episode of three written by the writer Anthony Skeen.
Huh. But that's funny because in this one, if you were to like follow the plot of him and his cat having their like little relationship... it seems like he's a spurned lover in this one, and when he sees the cat in Many Happy Returns, he's very indifferent to it.
Yeah.
So it sort of makes sense like for this one to go before Many Happy Returns, just based on his relationship with the Black Cat.
Well, I would actually say it works being set after, because he's got like this, it's almost like he's got a, you could look at it as him having this renewed hatred towards the village after what happened the previous week where he actually got out.
Right.
But, you know, again, that's all just what you're reading. It's really strange. I've never seen a show like this where you have so much to work with in terms of you can build your own storyline, basically.
Yes,
depending on what you're picking out of each episode.
That's true. The shows in and of themselves are very sort of plug and play. There's like a general I do feel there's a story in there somewhere. And just due to the way that the production happened, it doesn't really work out that way. Yeah, it's interesting though. Just to clarify, you were happy with this episode or in the order we've been watching it.
I meant as a follow up to Many Happy Returns. I do think this, like I said earlier, I think this should probably be like number four, where because it takes the formula and bends it in a way that I don't think would have been good for a second episode. Because they hadn't really established the formula yet.
Right.
But you've done a couple.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, I just remember when I watched to back up your point, when I watched the second episode, I was relieved that it was kind of a normal episode of television. Where the pilot is very avant-garde, sort of, and not particularly clear about what it's trying to say. What's the second one we watched? Chimes of Big Ben, right?
Yeah.
So Chimes is actually a normal television show,
right?
Which was kind of a relief at that point to ground yourself as a viewer.
Yeah.
So I can see that.
This is your world. I am your world. If you insist on living a dream, you may be taken for mad.
I like my dream.
Then you are mad. Now go on up to the town hall.
May I?
You may enter tonight. It's carnival.
I really feel that the main problem with this one is that the script doesn't hit the points it's trying to make strongly. It's like you were saying how it's very dreamy and it just kind of floats along.
Yeah.
There's a lot of important plot developments here. And there's a lot of like darkness to the way that things are going.
Right.
And I don't think that they shot it or the script didn't hammer those points home well enough to really grab your attention. Maybe there's almost too much of it in one episode. But I think if you had strengthened the shooting of this one and only focus on maybe one or two of the things that they're talking about here, I think it's a great second episode that could have been a normal TV show.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there are a few things that stood out or I should say that stand out to me as being, hanging tags left from whatever the original storyline was.
Okay. We don't know anything about the original script.
I tried to see if I could find it somewhere to read it, but I couldn't find it anywhere. I think it shows up in a book that you can buy that's full of the scripts.
Was McGoohan's problem with the script or the cut that they had put on
it? It was the cut of the show. Okay. I guess he didn't think the show worked.
Huh.
And the only thing that I could find was a reference to after there was a burial scene that was cut out that I don't know if it was a burial of...
The body he finds?
Yeah, if it was the body he finds or just another person or if it was supposed to be like a ceremonial burial of him or something.
Yep.
And there in the final scene where number two...
See, and that sort of fits in the Many Happy Returns because they stress the point that it had a graveyard.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Right.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the only other thing I could find was a cut scene that I don't think, if I remember reading correctly, it was the very final scene was not actually shot, where Six has some sort of retort to...
Two's laugh-inducing
witticism.
Yeah, because I mean, it does sort of the ending here feels like it just sort of ends. It doesn't really wrap up itself.
Mm-hmm.
even, you know, it would feel more conclusive if you put a shot back on number six of like his horrified reaction or something. It sort of feels like it just cuts out of nowhere to the very Batman-esque ending where the bars slam shut over the screen or whatever, and then like a pan of his face.
The final scene, the final scene after the back and forth at the end, number six says something to the effect of death has its advantages, and then leaves the room and joins the party.
Okay.
Which is, you know, I don't think ads are really, I don't think the addition of that scene would really add much except for him to be like, if you wanted to pick a point where number six's attitude towards the village turns, that could be it.
Oh, see, I'd read that more as number two is not above the village, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Like, number two is willing to sort of... It's sort of saying that the number twos aren't above and beyond what's going on. They're sort of a part of it.
Mm.
And that they're willing to be parts of it.
Mm.
Because I think you could... Now that I'm looking back on it, you can kind of think that the number twos are running the show and not really being wholeheartedly like buying into what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Where this, that line would sort of set the other way.
Mm.
I have my duty.
To whom?
To everyone. It's the rules. Of the people, by the people, for the people.
Takes on a new meaning.
You're a wicked man.
Wicked?
You have no value.
Different values.
You won't be helped.
Destroyed.
You want to spoil things.
I won't be a goldfish in a bowl.
So, a couple of the other things that stood out as seemingly dead plot lines, or at least not explained, is the telex machine never really made a ton of sense to me. Like, you never find out who is sending or who is receiving that.
I did a little bit of reading after watching the second time about this one. I thought I read some review that clarified what was going on, and I assumed I just missed it, that it was so subtle.
Do you remember what it said?
They were saying, they were sending like a fax about his death or something.
Oh, well, I mean, that makes sense.
It made sense. I just, when I watched it the first, those two times, it, like in the second time, I figured I would have noticed it, but I never did. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's never something that they zero in on and explain.
Right. It might just be the reviewer sort of drawing conclusions, I guess. Yeah. But
I mean, I like the visual of, as I've said before, analog is a much better storyteller than digital.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the meaning you can take from his destruction of the machine, and then the machine just starts up again. It's kind of a metaphor for the entire series, really.
Yeah, it is. He's helpless and things are beyond sort of his comprehension. You can destroy this machine, it'll still work.
Right. But as for its practical application in the episode, I guess you can take it as being sending a fax announcing his death. But yeah, that's one thing that I thought maybe had some more explanation in the original script or something.
Yes, yeah.
The other thing is when number six is caught with the radio up on that little parapet thing.
Mm-hmm.
By number two and number 240.
Yeah.
Or Little Bo Peep.
Yep.
For that matter. The exchange that, after number two leaves, the exchange that 240 and six have is really weird. I listened to it back a few times and I was trying to really parse it out, because they have an interesting back and forth that I want to talk about in terms of her character, because I think she's a really interesting character.
Okay. I mean, that's that conversation to me is like a perfect example of the show not really hitting me with what it's trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Because I watched that both times and I still have no idea what the hell they're talking about. Because, well, it's like everything is so... there's no clarity to their dialogue. They're very, you know, they're very snipey with each other all the time. And it's like, I never feel like there's any shot or any line that is like delivered with a, this is where we stand as characters.
Yeah. The thing that kept catching me off guard was the first half of it, I didn't have a problem with because it's 240 is berating six for being someone who doesn't want to fall in line and obey the rules, et cetera, et cetera. But then they have this exchange about the radio, in, like where she asks him if it's gonna do what he needs it to. Like there's an implication that she's trying to help him or something.
Right. Yeah.
Or she says, "Will I see you later?" Like as though they were gonna hang out or like they were in cahoots or something.
Right. Yeah. She's talking about the party though, right?
I guess. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, I don't know. It was just that little bit seemed like, oh, I don't know, maybe. And clearly at the end, when he's sentenced, she is upset about the sentence.
Yeah, well, so, I think it ties into the, that's kind of the way that women are in this show. They're sort of, they're a part of the village, but they seem to have at least, you know, some kind of remorse about what they're doing to number six.
Mm. Well, that actually brings me to what I really wanted to talk about concerning her is I think she is really interesting and kind of unique in that she seems to be a character who is not explicitly there because she has been put there as a prisoner. She, her role in her dialogue seems to be that of, you know, using your Cold War scenarios, someone who is living in, you know, a communist state or dictatorial state who is totally on board with the government that she's living under.
Okay.
Because there's a point where Six asks her what she did to be brought there, and she doesn't answer him, and she kind of, you know, she doesn't, I don't think she skirts the question completely, but she just, it's like...
It's unimportant.
She doesn't have an answer.
Yeah.
And her... The stuff that she says where she's spouting back, you know, the catchphrases, questions are a burden to others and answers are a prison to oneself.
Yep.
And her legitimate, you know, anger at number six because he just won't fall in line. And she's got a certain reverence for the village where she's not there as a warder or as someone who is... not there under their own power almost. It's like she grew up there.
You're talking about the final scene where she's sort of, she has that little speech while he's on under trial or whatever.
Well, I'm talking about her throughout the episode.
Oh, okay. Cause I mean, I felt that at the end with the little speech she gives at the trial that she is remorseful of what's happening.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yes.
All right. Yeah.
And I think that's where you get, some interesting depth to her. The reviewer for the AV Club said that she's troubled when it comes to consequences, which I think, you know, is an apt description. And I think the thing with her that's really interesting is that, and maybe something that was lost in the cut or maybe just wasn't fully there, like you were saying, they don't know exactly what beats to hit.
Right.
Her reaction at the end seems like the reaction of someone who has come to be care about number six.
Yes,
so
yeah.
Her character arc makes more sense if her whole character is totally committed to the village, but then she meets number six and actually ends up having feelings for him, so then... You know, not necessarily romantic, but, you know, sees him as a human at the least.
Right. His sort of individualism is inspiring other people is kind of the thing I take away from it.
Yeah. And so when she's, even at the end, when they're doing the trial, you can tell in that scene that she, throughout the trial, is not, you know, she's a little upset.
Right.
She's not completely right with what's going on. So when they sentence him and she kind of, you know, I don't know if she screams or, you know, yells or something, but, yep. You know, that feels like the natural natural procession of that character, but it's not something they spend enough time with in the episode for it to really stick.
No. Well, I'm assuming she never comes back, right?
Not that I know of.
Yeah. So it's that kind of problem of he doesn't have anyone who will stick with him to develop as well. You know, yeah. they kill off these characters sometimes literally every episode.
Right.
Because it seems there's always someone that kind of agrees with him, yep. Whether it was that dude he sort of had a bromance with in the other episode or
number 12, yeah,
the lady scientist in that ABC. And I think it's tough for the show because they get rid of those characters and they can't do anything except for the initial kickstart that he is causing in all of them.
Right.
They can't develop it after that because there's only one show.
Still hope. No, my friend. Not for me. Such noble thoughts are long dead. Soon Roland Walter Dutton will cease to exist.
That goes right into the next thing I wanted to talk about, which was exactly that. Specifically in this episode, we meet a character named Roland Walter Dutton.
Good name. They crush all these names.
Well, there's so few of them. They get, you know, time to spend.
That's
them.
True, yeah.
But he is someone who knows Six, at least tangentially, from previous life. And
yet never calls him by name, which is one of those weird things.
Yeah.
Like if I showed up and I was being lobotomized and I saw you in this horrible place, I think the first thing is just be like, Clay, it's me, William Walton Dutton or whatever my name is.
Roland Walter Dutton. But he presents a really, he's a great character to have for this episode because the part he plays is someone that Six can identify with, but who is very clearly...
can't be rescued, sort of.
Yeah, he can't be rescued, but he's also incredibly expendable. So where they take great care of number Six and not to damage number Six, guys who are not important, like Dutton, they will just drill them until there's nothing left.
Yes, yeah. I just wanted to... say, I thought that guy might be the best actor I've seen on the series so far.
Yeah, he's good.
He is good. He plays understated very well. It felt the least theatrical out of all the actors that I've seen so far, where everyone is sort of playing a bigger thing than they are.
Right,
He was the first one that was sort of modern in his tone and being able to sort of convey a lot without being sort of dramatic about it.
Yeah, the scene where they have in the cave where he talks about how
he doesn't have anything left to give.
Right, and how even going back to the showing how expendable he is, he says flat out, "I told them everything I know."
Right,
and they don't believe me.
Yeah.
So I think he says something to the effect of, "They're just going to keep drilling me until I'm dead."
Yep.
And he plays that very well. He doesn't overdo it, and he just kind of...
he's accepted it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he plays it with acceptance. And that character, I think, presents an interesting problem for the show, which is what you were talking about a couple of minutes ago, in that for this show to work, there can't be anybody else in the prison that Six knows or could possibly befriend.
Right, yeah.
Because I don't know if I actually know really how to explain it, but if he has someone that he knows or can conspire with, then there's no reason why he can't work on a better... I don't know. There's something about these characters where if he has someone else there that he knows or can conspire with, then the show doesn't work.
Right. Because him being alone is sort of the greatest damage that the village can do.
Yes.
You know, if he had one other person, that means that it's possible to correct things. Mm. You know? And the episode sort of removing that character is just sort of the final humiliation, I guess, if for lack of a better word, about like everything here is hopeless. You can't possibly build anything.
Right. I think you hit it. I think it's the isolation factor of it is very important.
Yeah.
and especially when it comes to breaking down these people that he supposedly knows from the previous life. And in this episode, it's very emphasized because as at the end of the episode, he's dead to the world.
Yeah, yep.
So there should be nobody else in the village that he knows.
Right.
But, you know, then you start thinking about the larger implications of that, where it's like, well, who the hell is in this village then?
Right, exactly.
I mean, the world of international spies is probably not as big as you might think it is, so he probably should know somebody, but...
Yeah, and he must be some kind of super spy, obviously, if these lesser spies are just getting the, you know, the lobotomy treatment.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that stuff plays into what we've talked about in the past about... The stuff inside the world of the show being more important than the stuff that theoretically would exist in the real world.
Right. Now, yes. Yeah. This is all taking place on a holodeck.
Yeah, probably. It's you know, at this point in the show, it wouldn't surprise me if that was an episode they didn't shoot.
You're waiting for someone, Mr. Tuxedo, or expecting someone?
Mr. Peter Pan?
So it seems.
With his shadow?
You're being hostile again.
And I just wanted to, like, I think my only other point that I wanted to touch on is the number two in this episode. Mm-hmm. A very strong number two.
Yeah, she's very good.
She kind of reminds me of a chimpanzee for whatever reason because she's so small. but she, the fact that she's, I thought it was clever that she's Peter Pan,
right?
A role that's traditionally always played by a woman.
Yeah, she's kind of like she's old enough where she's kind of craggy looking.
Yep.
And you know, having this old, evil looking Peter Pan is a nice touch to the person who runs what is, you know, essentially Neverland.
Yeah, she's like she's the right size. The sort of, you know, never grow up thing is kind of a village analog. Just I thought it was clever. I thought she did a very good job. She has a charisma on screen. She's sort of nasty without it being unlikable, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And she's efficient and probably an unusual role for a female, I'm assuming, at this point in history.
Yeah, I would think so, especially in sci-fi.
She's definitely the most aggressive of the female, because the other female number twos, have we only seen one?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
The last episode, yeah.
They're usually, there was the helicopter one that we weren't sure if she was a number two.
Oh, right.
I consider her, but they're more traditionally matronly.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, she's just compared to even the last episode where number two in the previous episode is literally like a very kindly, you know, middle-aged woman next door.
Right. Yeah.
This number two is arguably more aggressive than even most of the men.
Yes. Yeah. She definitely,
which is great.
Yep.
You know, she plays it really well, and I think the costumes are great. The costumes at the party are really good, I think. Her having Peter Pan and
Little Bo Peep is
Little Bo Peep is great because, I mean, her role as the observer. Actually, that's another thing that I want to... Because in the very first episode, a big part of the plot is how that one woman is the observer for the other guy that Six knows, Cobb, who jumps out the window.
Right, yeah.
And it seems like a part of the series that they kind of threw in as like, all right, we'll do something with this. This will be part of the show that we'll work on. That'll always keep popping up. Like, oh, the observers, you know, like kind of like the Watchers on Buffy or Highlander.
Sure. Yep.
But then it never shows up again after that first episode.
Mm-hmm.
But this episode actually uses that and then effectively gets rid of it because in a way that makes sense, because at the end of the episode, when he's declared dead, number two says to Six, she's no longer your observer because, you know, dead people don't need to be observed.
Right. Yeah.
Which is also another great shot to number six, because she's basically telling him that he exists so little and is so worthless now that they don't even need to watch him. They don't even need to have the usual observer watch after him.
Right. Yeah. Which I think ties into the earliness of the episode, or where I would place it. You know, it's setting a lot of ground rules, I guess would be the better way to put it, for the series.
In his pocket.
The wallet?
Yes.
It's still there. Amended slightly. We'll amend him slightly. It's you who's died in an accident at sea. A mayor.
So to the outside world.
Which you only dream about.
I'll be dead.
A small confirmation of a known fact.
So the last thing, since it's tough to rate the plan for this one because there's not really it's a tough one to rate number two's plan. But in order to do that, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Did number two manufacture the dead body?
Yes.
So do you think she set all of that in motion?
I'm inclined to say yes, but I could probably be convinced to no. So I guess I don't have a strong yes stance on it. I'd have to think they either did or... I'm inclined to think that she did.
Yeah. Yeah, I would tend to agree.
Yeah, okay.
Again, it's not something that's heavily emphasized, but... the way that it plays out seems to be manufactured in the fact that he finds the radio, which is what gets him put on trial, which is what gets him sentenced to death.
Yeah, that's true. What did he find on the guy? He just found a picture of his kids or something?
He found the radio and he found the guy's wallet that had a picture of, I assume, the guy and his wife. We never get a good look at the guy's face.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'd have to assume it was all set up. There's no... to sort of rate number two's plot here, there's not a lot that's not out of her grasp for this one. So, I mean, if we were going on our ranking system, I'd give her a 5. I know that her plot doesn't have a lot of mechanics or mechanisms sort of going along with it, but she has done her job probably better than any of the other number twos. Because he is in seemingly a hopeless spot at the end of this.
Right.
She didn't break him, but she's the referee that sort of set the rules for the game more than any of the others have.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think the plot itself, or the plan itself is one of those Chimes of Big Ben type ones where in order for it to work, so many things have to go right.
Right. Yeah.
And, so many variables have to be, constrained, but in terms of the effectiveness of the end result, I would say yes, definitely a 5.
Nice agreement right there.
Yeah. No, this is I was really interested what you were going to say about this episode because I very vividly remembered the first time I watched it and thinking it was garbage.
Yeah. Right.
And then I've read other things about people who really, really like this episode. And I was like, what are you talking about? This is just like nonsense.
Yeah, right.
And then watching it again, I was like, wow, this is so dark.
It definitely is. I think it's just like I was saying earlier, I just think the tone disguises what this show is actually saying, this episode in particular. That would be the one thing, like, if you were going to shot for shot remake the series, I don't know what the AV or the AMC version is, probably not a remake, but
no,
I just think that this one should be like directed by like David Fincher, you know?
Yeah.
Like something that's like cold and sort of like very clean but very very dark to it. Because as it is, it's sort of his cheerful demeanor doesn't really convey what's happening to him. You know, he's sort of whistling along and like walking down the beach and things, and you're like, oh, he's not really accomplishing anything. But then a lot's going on.
Well, I don't know, because I saw him to be very, very angry through the episode.
Well, he certainly hits a boiling over frustration point when they're trying to get him to fall asleep and he jumps out the window and runs and Grover gets him. Like, that's probably the most desperate he's ever been. Outside of maybe the pilot when he's just trying to get away the first time and he punches the guys on the golf cart.
Yep.
But yeah, he's frustrated, but I think McGoohan never plays him to a point where he is showing any kind of weakness, really, beyond frustration. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know if maybe that's a good thing or a bad thing. Because you never really, no matter how the plots are affecting him, he's always kind of the same.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess when you're talking about him being sort of not cheerful, but cheerful or sort of passive or something.
Yeah.
I was thinking, well, he's not the way he acted in The General, where he was like, yeah, whatever, I don't give a shit.
Right.
You want this recorder? Here, take it. I don't need it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Who's the general? I don't really care and don't really have a stake in any of this, but I just need to know so we can fill 40 minutes.
Exactly, yeah.
But yeah, I on rewatch, I really enjoy this episode. I think, see, for me, I love the stuff that's gets weird and dreamy. I would go, if it was up to me completely, I would go with someone like David Lynch and actually push it further.
Right.
Would that be a benefit to the series as a whole? Probably not, but it would be a cool episode.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. The two Davids. Maybe they can split scenes or something like that.
Maybe we'll fall somewhere in the middle and get David Cronenberg to do it. And number six can pull the radio out of the chest cavity of the body he finds.
And then its head explodes for no particular reason.
Actually, funny enough, Patrick McGoohan is in David Cronenberg's movie Scanners.
Oh, is he really?
Yep.
Oh.
Yep. The one where the head explodes.
Yeah. Out. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. He's pretty great in it too.
Oh, interesting. Is he a bad guy?
No, he's the guy who he's kind of like the Obi-Wan character. He teaches the young scanner guy how to use his powers.
Oh,
and stuff.
Excellent. All right.
Yeah, he's pretty great.
That makes sense.
I mean, he's pretty great in pretty much everything.
Now drink it while it's hot.
What is it?
It's good for you.
Good for someone.
And be seeing you.
And you.
But yeah, that about wraps it up, I think. This is a really interesting episode to talk about. Hopefully it made sense. We kind of jumped around a lot.
Yeah, the episode kind of jumps around, though. It fits that theme.
Yeah, well, I'll shelve this episode for maybe 3 or 4 months, and then I'll go back and take another pass at editing it. Just right. Chop the hell out of it.
You'll show me the first cut, and I'll be like, what the fuck were we talking about? But you need to get in there and fix it.
But yeah, do you have anything you want to plug?
Sure. We're running through Star Trek, the Next Generation episodes on our very own podcast. You can go to thepenskypodcast.com, get all that good stuff. And there's the YouTube channel. It's all up on YouTube as well. You can just go to YouTube/thepenskyfilevideo, and it's all there as well.
Cool. And if you want to get in touch with me, again, I am by no means an expert in this. So if you have anything you want to comment on or yell at me about, you can email me at theprisonerpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @prisonerpodcast. And we are also on Facebook and I don't know, some other websites I probably started to make but then forgot about.
All social media.
Yeah.
We got a Tumblr, we've got a what's the one you sell stuff on? An Etsy.
An Etsy.
You made hand knitting prisoner gloves.
I sell cassette tapes of the podcast. That's actually a pretty good idea. I should do that.
It probably is, yeah. Or just you can play it in that machine that you can rip the wires out and it still works. Just shove whatever's in there.
And if you're into dark, John Carpenter-y kind of comic books, I do an online graphic novel called Dead Meat, which you can find at eatdeadmeat.com. There's 8 issues on the website, and there's videos and all sorts of fun stuff.
Absolutely.
But that's about it. Thank you, Wes, for joining me again, and we'll see you next time with Checkmate.
Good. Sounds good to me.
Well, there's Dance of the Dead. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to mention again that we are now on iTunes, so if you really enjoyed this episode and you want to give us a positive rating or review, that would be much appreciated. So, we will see you next time with Checkmate.